Hello and welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 264, and we're going to talk about the impact of some recent legislation that passed in the U.S. And, well, yeah. We're also going to talk about solar panels that you can use for your all-in-one solar generator, hate that term, and a product review of a computer that might be ideal for van life. Hello everyone, welcome back. I am on a ship. Big surprise. This is the last cruise of three that I have had scheduled for these last 6 weeks. I'm a little bit tired. And I didn't want to miss another podcast, so I've decided to try to record this on board, which has not worked very well in the past, but I am currently in my cabin in the bowels of a celebrity reflection, sailing through the Florida Straits at a brisk 5 knots, which is about walking speed. We're in no hurry to get to Key West, apparently, which is fine. But during all my travels, we had a major piece of legislation pass in the U.S., and this is not a politics podcast, and you can find endless people talking about this bill and its impact and all of this. But I wanted to frame it just in terms of how it impacts people doing van life, digital nomads, people who dispersed camp on public lands, all those kind of things. And, well, it's interesting because these days, when you're doing research, at least me, and I imagine a whole lot of other people, you start with AI. I mean, the world has shifted now that the web is kind of a secondary way to find information. You start with the AI, like ChatGPT or whatever, and then you get the information from there. You realize you can't trust it, so then you go and verify the information on the web. And what I'm finding with this particular thing is that the AI, it disagrees with itself. And fortunately, you can see the sources it pulls from. And when you look, the disagreement comes from the fact that everything disagrees now. I mean, there are as many proponents of this, well, I shouldn't say that. There are as many loud proponents of this bill as there are loud voices against it. And the AI, which has not a truth engine, it has no way to discern truth or not, it does its best. And so I don't understand why it's a different answer every time, but when you ask, it will say this is a great thing for campers, or it will say it's a terrible thing for campers. So you have to apply critical thinking more now than ever, and that's what I'm going to attempt to do here. But it is not perfect, and any analysis I have could easily be dismissed by somebody else with their analysis. However, I think it's pretty clear that there's been a drastic shift in things, and it will affect van life. So the first and probably most impactful part of this bill revolves around public lands, BLM land, Bureau of Land Management in the U.S. This is similar to Crown Lands in Canada, which of course are not affected by this being its own separate country, which is news to some folks. Now, there were all kinds of proposals before the bill actually passed to sell off public lands and such, it's particularly those bills that were sponsored by Mike Lee of Utah, and a lot of that was removed, which is good news. But it's not all good news. There are two basic things that they did do. The first is that they are allowing more access to public lands for mining and forestry and things like that. And, well, let's take a little sidebar here. The U.S. owns a bunch of public land, and it's all in different categories. For example, there's BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, which is federally owned land that can be used for a number of things. It can be used for camping, or it can be used to graze cattle. You need a permit for whatever, but it's meant for the public use for the many things the public uses land for. Then there is the Department of Forestry. They have their own land and they have their own separate rules. For example, a lot of the timber we have in the U.S. comes from public land. It is legal. It's harvesting timber from public lands. And then we have national parks that are protected. These are protected space that none of this stuff can happen on. What has happened with this bill is the regulation of what activities can occur in this land has been eased, shall we say, and it's much easier now to do something potentially harmful to the environment on these lands, such as mining or drilling for oil, etc. So that's not too surprising, and this goes back and forth with administrations. You can go back in time and see, oh, we've got more public land that's protected. Oh, all those protections have been removed. Bears Ears in Utah has been going back and forth. So, okay, disappointing from the perspective of a van life person and someone who loves the outdoors, etc., but not terribly unexpected. The other part, though, is in a way worse. They've removed funding for a lot of the maintenance and upkeep of our public lands for things such as trail maintenance and national park services and all that. Their funding has been cut pretty dramatically. And I think what that's going to mean is we're going to have fewer resources in these parks. We're going to have much less enforcement of existing laws. You're going to see things like bathrooms not being open anymore, campgrounds closed, trails that wash out will not be fixed. They're going to stay that way. And that means that eventually we're going to have a big storm or flood. And yes, my heart goes out to folks in Texas. That is absolutely horrific. But the damage won't be fixed. Death Valley had a huge, huge series of flash floods a couple of years ago that caused amazing damage that's still being worked on. And so far as I can tell, that will stop. Now, I don't know that specifically, but that is the kind of thing we're looking at here, where their funding is just being pulled. So something bad happens to a trail, that's okay, we don't have that trail anymore. And that's the argument. So I don't think that's great. And the other aspect we need to talk about, and this is actually more serious, although it doesn't affect everybody in van life, it's the cut to SNAP and other health-related services. I mean, food is part of health. This is going to be tricky for nomads. First off, SNAP is more commonly known as food stamps. You know, it's a program that the federal government funds, and they basically will give money to states, and then the states typically run the program. So different states have different names for it. But it's the idea that people who have low income can get food support and receive coupons or a debit card or however it works, go to the grocery store and get basic groceries for a reduced or even free cost, no cost. And this has been my whole life. I mean, I'm 50-something years old, and as far as I can remember, this has existed. It's still going to exist, but what they've done is they've tightened the restrictions, and they've really set it up so that you have to almost have a full-time job to be able to qualify for these programs. And while at the face of it, at the most basic level, that doesn't seem unreasonable. It's like, well, if you can work, why shouldn't you work? You know, you want something from the government, go ahead and work for it. And okay, sure. But not everyone's in that situation. Not everyone can work. You know, if you're a single mother, three kids, suddenly your husband dies, you have no health insurance, no life insurance, and you've got three kids to feed, I don't know what kind of a job you're going to be able to get that is going to pay enough to, you know, feed and house you and your kids, not to mention daycare for the time that you're working and away from your kids. And that's the kind of thing that SNAP was originally set up to do, is to help folks like that who are in a temporary situation. You know, those kids are going to get older, they're going to go to school, etc. But now it's much harder. And now apply that to the digital nomads. Let's say that you are a gig worker. Okay, so, you know, you're making it. You're doing okay. You're doing whatever your gig is, and you're bringing in enough money. You can live in your van anywhere you want. Things are good. But let's say you're just on the edge, and so you do qualify for some SNAP. Well, now, when they come and say, you have to show us your employment, does that count as employment? Does passive income count as employment? It becomes very tricky, and my guess is that none of that is going to be seen as employment. So if you're getting a couple thousand dollars a month from your wildly successful YouTube channel or whatever, that is enough to live in a van with some help from SNAP, probably, maybe, depending on how you live. But that SNAP may be going away for you because you're not going to be able to prove that you, quote unquote, have a job. So it's definitely something to be concerned about if you are a lower income person in you're on any kind of public assistance. You need to get educated on the changes that are coming immediately and make a plan for what you're going to do. Now, usually in response to things like this, food banks ramp up. Because there are people who care in the world, and they want to respond to things, and they want to make sure everyone's fed. So if you are someone who is in desperate need of help, make sure you know where your network of food banks is, and food pantries, little free pantries. You know, they're all over the country. They're going to be under a lot of pressure. I remember I was in Aurora, Missouri, and I just happened to be there on the day that the local food pantry had a drive-through food pantry service. And there were maybe 150 cars in line. And after 75 cars, they said, sorry, we're out of food. So it requires planning. And it's going to be an interesting time. I don't know what's going to happen, obviously. But I do think that these legislative changes are going to make it more difficult to do van life. And that makes me sad. On top of that, aside from this bill, some states continue to crack down on quote-unquote homelessness, which they do not distinguish from people living in vans. They don't see a van as a home. You're homeless. You don't have a house or an apartment. You're a homeless person. That's how they see it. And that's how the laws are written. Tennessee, we've talked about it, is a felony to do so much as to cook in your van on public property in Tennessee. Mississippi apparently is following suit. There will be no camping or sleeping in your vehicle on any public land. Of course, what's public land? Is the Walmart parking lot public land? It depends on definitions, believe it or not. You would think that would be clearly private land, except that, well, maybe it's not, because maybe that Walmart's in a shopping center, and the land the shopping center is on is owned by the municipality. Anyway. It's going to get complicated and hard. So looking into this a bit deeper, I see that there was some legislation passed in some of the states where they've basically reined in the power of the police, such that you will have 24 hours notice to vacate the premises, basically. So if you're sleeping, like let's say you go to a public park, which is actually not a great idea. Stealth camping in public parks is difficult because they're well patrolled. But let's say you do that. You get the knock at 4 a.m., by law, in some states now, they have to give you a notice to leave, and you've got 24 hours to leave. And that way, you're not arrested instantly. They've also capped the fine in some states to $50, which is not terrible, or 6 months in jail, which somehow does not equate to $50 to me. And who gets to decide which? Well, the judge. And that's based on what the cops tell them. And of course, there's other rules that they can kick you out on too. I mean, this is just this one law and how it will be enforced. But if you're in a public park after dark, even if there aren't signs, they can say, hey, this park is closed after dark. You are trespassing. And then you can get a trespassing charge, which is separate from all of this. So folks, all I can say is it's getting more difficult out there. The things we used to know for certain, like BLM land was there, you could use it for 2 weeks at a time, no worries. It's no longer certain. There are forces in society that do not like people who live alternate lifestyles. That's always been the case. It's always been the case with van life. Those forces are now in power, and they're using that power, and they're getting stronger. So that means if you wish to live this alternate lifestyle, which I do, and I know most of you do, because that's why you're listening to the podcast, you're going to have to be very clever and pay close attention so you don't get in trouble. And I would argue that means you have to be prepared to move a lot and at a moment's notice. That's going to be your best chance of surviving this. Flexibility. What's going to happen in places like Quartzsite? I don't know. They so far haven't come up in the radar of these bills so far as I can see. But Slab City, Quartzsite, the places where people go and it's kind of the wild, wild west and lawless, I don't think it's going to take too long before someone casts their eye there and tries to get rid of that too. So I wish I had better news. I wish I had better advice. I think that if you were looking to maybe do an extended tour of Europe or Canada or South America, or you wanted to get out of the country for a while, that's not a bad idea. This might be the time to do that. But based on my recent experiences traveling abroad, I wouldn't be too loud about the fact that you're an American. I didn't have anything bad happen to me. In fact, most people expressed sympathy. They were like, oh, wow, you're an American. Yeah. That's just my experience. I most people I've talked to overseas, feel bad for us or worse. So anyway, that's enough about politics, but this is a time to pay attention to what's going on, at least a little bit, because some of this legislation is affecting van life and it's going to make it more difficult. And I really wish that wasn't the case. A big thank you to Bryn and Terry for buying me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. You guys have made it such that I do not have to have ads on the podcast, and I really appreciate that because ads are annoying and I'm tired of them. So thank you, Bryn and Terry, and thank you to everyone who donates every month. You're the reason that I can stop talking now and get back to the content. If anyone else would like to join them, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, and I promise I will change that diesel to something else as soon as I can. Tech Talk. I was having a very brief chat with Nelly in a can this morning. She's looking at solar panels, and she's got an interesting situation where she's in a Ford Transit Express, but her roof is taken up with boxes. So she's looking at portable panels, and this is new to her, so she's wondering, you know, can I use this panel with this all-in-one power station, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought maybe I would address the idea that solar generators, which is a term that is wrong twice, power stations, all in one units that have an inverter and a battery and everything all built in one. Think Jackery, think Gold Zero, think Blue Eddy, think EcoFlow, all those. You can charge them with any solar panel you want. I mean, basically, it's true. So what these companies will do is they'll try to sell you their brand of solar panel, right? So if you buy a Jackery, you'll get a thing, oh, Jackery solar panels, and there'll be adapters and stuff. And the solar panels are the same. It's just the connector that's different. And there are endless adapters out there. For me, I have three solar power stations. I have two Chinese knockoff brands that I don't even remember the name of, and I have a Jackery 1500, an older one. And I charge them all the same way with 100 watt rigid solar panels with MC4 connectors. Now, none of those power stations have MC4 connectors. It doesn't matter. All I have to do is adapt that MC4 connector to what they take. And so it's interesting. The two Chinese solar generators use mini Anderson connectors, but they reverse the polarity. One of them has, I'll just say it this way, just to be as visual as I can in a podcast. One of them has positive on the right and ground on the left, and the other has it reversed. So the nice thing about Anderson connectors is you can take them apart very simply. They just unsnap and swap the sides. And I have to do that for each one, depending on how I'm going to charge it. But they charge just fine because remember, these things have a solar controller built into them. You don't need a solar controller to charge it. I'll say at least most solar generators. All you have to do is get the solar in there. And because of that, there's a wide range of voltages and wattages that they'll accept. Yes, there's a maximum. Don't go crazy. Don't try to hook up 2,000 watts of solar to one of these things. It won't be able to handle it. But usually up to 400 watts is fine. You just need to adapt it properly. Most solar panels that are affordable come with MC4 connectors. All you have to do is figure out what connector your solar generator needs and then find an MC4 to that kind of connector adapter, and you're good to go. And you can, if you have a big brand name like Jackery, you can just search MC4 to Jackery adapter, and it will have an MC4 to a barrel connector that's specific to the size the Jackery needs, and you can charge your Jackery with that. It's very easy. So don't think that you have to buy the same brand solar panel with the same solar generator. That is not true. All you have to do is make them connect. And the reason this is really a big deal is because the cheapest way to get solar panels is just to get an off-brand, or not even an off-brand, like Rich Solar or Set Power or something like that, and hook them up. So in my case, I have two solar, I actually have more than two, but I have a lot of solar panels on the roof of the Tiki Bago, but there's two that don't go to the Tiki Bago. They just go to a cable, and I use those to charge my solar stations. And it's no problem at all. The only thing you have to watch out for is if you get a portable solar panel that has a built-in solar charge controller, because there are some RVs that use that. They have a plug on the outside, I think it's called a zero amp. I can't remember the name of it. It's got a funny name, and I'm sorry. I'm in a position where I can't look things up, but it's basically an SAE connector. And that is just literally a connector that doesn't, it connects right to the batteries. So there is no controller there. So you want panels that don't have a controller, which are going to be the cheaper ones, which are going to be the ones that are easier to find. But if you have an RV that has one of those ZAMP, that's what it is, one of those ZAMP connectors on the outside, those do need a solar controller. And I'm sorry this stuff gets so complicated so quickly. A lot of that is just marketing and such. You know, we have standards. There are standard connectors, but people don't want to use them because they make more money if people are confused. They make more money if people think they have to stick with the same brand, which is going to lead us to our next segment. Product review. So I just bought a new computer. Did I need a new computer? No. Do I want a new computer? Yes. The reason is that I have been relying on my 2021 MacBook Pro for, well, let's see, 2021 at 4 years, and it's been fine. It's a great computer. It's been a powerhouse. Yes, Mac, Windows, I get it. I'm in the Mac world. I don't need to debate the two. They both have pros and cons, but I'm in the Mac world. So when I'm looking to buy a computer, I'm looking for a Mac. The problem with my MacBook Pro is that it's very, very heavy. And it's so heavy that I don't actually want to bring it with me on trips. And so what I will do is I will say, well, I'm going to be walking a lot on this trip. I got to travel light. I'll just bring my iPad. And I've got a nice iPad. It's an iPad Pro 2 or whatever with the keyboard, the Magic Keyboard. It's actually a nice way to travel very, very light. But every time I've done this, I've been disappointed because there's something I want to do that the iPad won't let me do. It's incredibly frustrating because the iPad's power is there. It's the restrictions that software puts on it. They're like, oh, it's just an iPad. Well, we can't let you do this. I'm like, yes, you can. Ugh, it's so frustrating. It's happened many times. So I decided to buy a new travel Mac. And what I ended up buying was a MacBook Air. It was about $1,200. 16 gigabytes of RAM, and I got the terabyte drive. And you can configure these in a whole bunch of different ways. Never get anything less than 16 gigabytes of RAM, I can tell you that. Hard drive space, you can supplement, whatever. But I did some benchmark testing. So I've got a 2025 MacBook Air. I did some benchmark testing for video production, which is very difficult for a computer, against my MacBook Pro, and it came out the same. Basically, this MacBook Air has the same amount of processing power as my 2021 MacBook Pro, and it weighs a quarter as much. It weighs just slightly more than my iPad. Now, I've got the 13-inch, which is the small one these days, so I have a smaller screen, obviously. The resolution is a little bit less, but for travel, I actually have all the power I do with my MacBook Pro in a very light form, and it's great. But there's another advantage for van life that I didn't realize until I got this. It needs a lot less power to charge. In fact, it comes with a little, kind of a wimpy 35-watt charger. And I can charge this thing to full pretty quickly with just a cheap $20 USB-C charger. And like, that makes this pretty darn good for van life. Also, it's thin and tiny, and you can hide it in your van in a lot of places. You can certainly put it someplace where someone breaking into your van wouldn't find it. It's, you know, it's fairly durable. Apple builds quality stuff, so that's not an issue. There is one issue, which is that it has two USB-C ports. It has a MagSafe power port that you can use or not. You can charge it USB, and it has a headphone jack, and that's it. No SD card slots, no USB-A slots, ports, nothing else. So everything you're going to do with this computer has to be through those two USB-C ports. Now, fortunately, they make things that plug in there that give you all those adapters and such as an HDMI port, for example, or a mini DVI, or Ethernet, all those things. So you do have to deal with adapters, but this is meant to be kind of like a travel computer, and I think it's pretty darn good. And for me, $1,200 is not an unreasonable amount to spend for a computer. I know a lot of the Windows folks are like, holy cow, I would never spend that much. I'd only spend half as much. I get it. It's fine. I'm not complaining. I'm not saying that your way is wrong and my way is and better or in any way. It's just I'm in the Mac ecosystem and I'm not willing to change. I do have a PC and every time I use it, I'm like, oh, I want to be back on my Mac. And I'm sure Windows users have the same experience. So if you are thinking about getting a computer and you're the kind of person who like needs a powerhouse, well, you know, the MacBook Air is pretty darn powerful. That M4 chip really makes up for a lot, and it might be all you need, especially at that price point, because the MacBook Pros are twice as much. So I'll have a link in the show notes, but I think you know where to find them. Tales from the Road. So we just got through the Bermuda Triangle, and we're going to go back because we're crazy people. But I do have a tale about the Bermuda Triangle. No, it's not the one where my wife appeared from the buffet carrying a platter of bacon saying, "Would anyone like some?" And then we got married. No, it's not that story. It's one of my favorite stories. No, it's a different one. The very first one of these trips I organized for the James Randi Educational Foundation was to basically be a seance in the Bermuda Triangle. That was the goal. And we did. We did a seance with a glow-in-the-dark Ouija board in the Library of Enchantment of the Seas in the Bermuda Triangle. And the results were as predicted. However, of all these trips I've done, and there have been dozens, that was the only trip where we actually lost someone on the trip. We went into the Bermuda Triangle and came out missing someone. And it's actually a little bit tragic. So when I say missing, I mean that they were not with us anymore. We knew where they were. It's not like they just disappeared. Like, oh, where did he go? He was on the deck and now he's gone. No, he was actually in the buffet and he slipped and fell, which is not that uncommon. But unfortunately, he had a medical condition that made his musculature weak. And when he fell, he actually broke the ball off of his femur. It's a fairly major injury. Now, ships have emergency rooms. They're very well staffed. It's actually a specialty. Ship medicine is an ER specialty. So the people are highly trained and they have everything they need down there to stabilize someone. But they don't do surgery on ships. I'm sorry, Dr. Odyssey, you are not the most realistic show in the world. But this poor guy, and he's high on drugs in the ship's hospital, and he needed to be taken off the ship and get some help. And what was worse is he was from Sweden, and we were in the Bermuda Triangle, so near the U.S. So they stabilized him. We had to go pack up his cabin and all his stuff, and we saw him go off the ship, but they didn't want to divert the ship to land, so they just kind of slowed down in Miami, literally right at the tip of the Bermuda Triangle. And a Coast Guard vessel came, and they deboarded him and put him on the Coast Guard vessel. And we all waved goodbye over the side, and off he went. And then the Coast Guard vessel lost power and was adrift in the Bermuda Triangle. And we didn't find out about this until later, but they actually had to be rescued. The Coast Guard needed to be rescued and then brought ashore. And then when they got him ashore and into the hospital, there was a big fight over his passport and such, but eventually, after some weeks, he got back home to Sweden and started his recovery, which took quite a while. And the really sad thing about this story is that we never saw him again. It wasn't that he didn't want to come travel with us again. It was that it really was too much for him because of his medical condition, and that always bothered me because that shouldn't be the case. You know, we should be able to support folks like that. And then sadly, I'm sorry to end on the sad note, he ended up dying a few years later of heart failure, and we had a memorial service for him and such. So Kernier, if you're out there listening to this, we still remember you and we wish you were with us. But it is a little odd that the only time we ever lost somebody on one of our trips was in the Bermuda Triangle. A place to visit. Since we're on this theme, I'm going to go back and revisit the SS Badger. Folks, this is also a PSA. Stay the heck out of Chicago if you're just driving through. This is a very, very bad year to be driving through Chicago. I-90 is a parking lot. It is horrible. I have to drive through it quite often. This year's especially bad because they have to replace all the bridges, basically all the overpasses that go over the city streets. And so they have to close major portions of what we call the Kennedy. It's a nightmare. And add, throw into that, we had NASCAR recently that messed everything up. And then there'll be the Air and Water Show and Taste of Chicago and all this stuff. Stay the heck out of Chicago. But if you look at a map of the U.S., you're kind of stuck going through Chicago, which is a big part of the problem, because there's this like big wet thing in the way. It's called Lake Michigan. And if you're coming from the northeast of the U.S. or heading to the northeast of the U.S., Lake Michigan's in your way, and you have to drive around it, and then you have to drive through Chicago. Except you don't. There are two ferries that cross Lake Michigan, and I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to have a much more pleasant experience taking those ferries. They both accept vehicles, and I mean big vehicles. You can have a full-size RV on at least one of these with no problem. So in the southern part of the lake, there's the fast ferry, we call it. And I'm not going to talk about that because that's just a ferry. It's fine. It's not an experience. I want to talk about an experience, and that is the SS Badger. This is a massive ferry that used to be a railroad ferry that is the last coal-burning ship in the United States that is in normal operation. And it goes from Manitowoc, Wisconsin to Ludington, Michigan, back and forth. It's about a four-hour trip. On this massive ferry that you will drive your rig onto, you're fine, doesn't matter how tall it is. Remember, this used to take railroad cars. It can handle it. You park, you go upstairs, and then there's a diner. They play bingo. It has a little museum. It has a movie theater. It has cabins if you want to rent a cabin. They were $50 last I did it. They're probably closer to $100 now because that's how inflation works. And you can have this amazing little mini cruise across Lake Michigan instead of sitting in Chicago traffic. This ship is an historic landmark. They've updated the engines many times, so it is burning the cleanest coal possible. They no longer dump the ashes into the lake like they used to. They're doing the best they can with the fact that it's a coal-burning ship. But it's just a lot of fun being on this thing. And I have to tell you, I saw the craziest thing the first time I went on this. Where they have to dock in Ludington is kind of tight. And the way they do it, they don't have bow thrusters or anything modern like that. They have an anchor. So when they get there, they drop anchor at speed and then pivot the ship around to get it in the right position to back into the dock. It's kind of an amazing little bit of seamanship. One that is a little scary the first time because you're like, really? That's how they do this? But no, seriously, I don't know how much longer this thing's going to last. This thing's really old. Coal stuff has just been eased by our government, so maybe it'll last a little longer than it was originally going to last, but it's quite the experience. It's not inexpensive. You know, you'll easily pay a couple $100 to take you and your van across. But I'll pay a couple $100 not to sit in Chicago traffic and have an experience. So I'll have a link in the show notes. It's just ssbadger.com. Even if you don't ride on this thing, take a look at it. It's a cool bit of history that's still around today and a fun way to travel. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to this rather odd podcast, but I got her done, and that was the goal here. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you need to get a hold of me, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember this quote by Bo Taplin, which is, "The sun rises even when we don't."